What's up? You're listening to Soft Difference, a podcast of Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. On this pod, you'll hear from Giorgio, Eric, and myself, Justin, talk about 1 Peter and how 1 Peter calls us to love Jesus and love others in the world. Welcome back to the Soft Difference pod. I'm Justin.
I'm Eric.
Here with my co-host, Eric.
We're tripping on each other. It's our first time together.
It is our first time together. Welcome, Eric. This is also like the after hours pod where we kind of like after the sermon, we riff a little bit about it and engage with some of the questions. We got some questions this week, so we're excited to answer those here at the end. But welcome.
Yeah, man. No, excited to be here. Excited to do this with you and play a little bit of the host role this week as we talk about your sermon, man.
Yeah. Let's go. Let's get it.
Sweet. Well, hey, let's talk maybe for a few minutes about process as you think about the sermon. And how did it come together for you last week? Like what was kind of going on in your heart and your head as you were preparing, and maybe take us into that process just a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, since I hadn't preached in a couple weeks here, I had been, started thinking about this one, far out in advance. I think our cultural moment, was obviously heavy with all the things that have happened in the last month.
Right.
And a lot of the responses that, you guys and I've seen online to the things happening in our world. So that was like kind of beating as a drum in the back of my head. Mm-hmm. When I preached a sermon the first time, it was like 2014. So it was before cultural change. And so as I like reflected back on the notes of that original sermon, I was like, there's some exegesis stuff that's obviously the things I can still hold on to.
Right.
But a lot of what's happened over the last 10 years, 15 years has changed.
And so
I wanted to like try to touch on a little bit of that without getting too far afield in it. And certainly like the tone of the church's efforts to try to take back culture has like amped up, and it's even more amped up right now than maybe ever, and we're feeling that in the church. And maybe some of you feel like me and like Eric feels, like it feels a little lonely in the postures and the positions we're maybe trying to take in regards to this, where we're not really wanting to engage in that sort of a culture war. But it feels lonely because it feels like a lot of the people around us in the church are quite comfortable moving in the wake of that or along the tidal flow of that.
Yeah.
And so how do I speak into that without like totally hammering it as well? Like being sympathetic or empathetic to the tendencies to want to do it. So that was heavy on my mind.
For sure.
I was like, thought about it.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. Yeah, that's good. That's good context.
When I woke up on Sunday morning at 3:00, I really felt the need to shift the sermon, to honor and shame, which I do think is quite prevalent in Peter's. I mean, this is honor. The whole thing starts with honoring the emperor.
Right, right.
And so that's really where that took root. I had been kind of like, it kind of maybe had been in the back of my mind, but when I woke up Sunday morning to actually like sit down and like write, put all the thoughts together and write it, that became the dominant thing that I felt like I was supposed to talk about.
Yeah, thought that was great. Yeah. It's wild that you pivoted at 3 a.m., but that's you, bro. It's great.
Yeah.
Why don't we jump into the passage? Yeah. So it's 1 Peter 2:13-17. I think you caught me a little off guard, and maybe the tech team as well, who didn't have a slide prepared. You added verses 11 and 12, which I preached on last week, in addition to a couple of verses prior to that as well. But yeah, talk about adding those back into your scripture passage to bring some like context and like literary context as you flowed into your verses.
Yeah, so I think, 11 and 12 are kind of like bridge verses for 1 Peter as it shifts from this first section, which is kind of like, very gospel building as a section. It's talking about what the gospel has done to us and who it's made us into. So, you're in Georgia's text is this spiritual living house I think about the old Harvey Kahn illustration. You know, Harvey has this great illustration where he talks about the church is the model home of the new kingdom. Like, you know, you guys have been to a model home, and like when you go into a model home, it's like kind of giving you a vision of what your new home will look like. And he goes, the church is the model home. It's this place that people are coming to come in and look around. And so I think that's what Peter's doing is he says, this is the spiritual house. This is what this spiritual house should do. Like, it should be this like this pervasive witness of what life in the kingdom looks like. So I think 11 and 12 kind of set that up. And then he goes in all these ethical like ways of living. And these handful of verses, like from 2 to 4, from the end of chapter 2 to chapter 4, like there's like some of the hardest passages, I think, in the Bible for us.
There's some tough ones in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, to remember that this is to give the reason for the hope that we have. And that means these like challenging ways of then being animated in the world. So that's why I included them.
No, yeah, I think that's great. Yeah, I think in a lot of the commentaries that I was looking at in my preparation for my own sermon, 11 and 12, they serve very much as like the introductory verses for like those chapters, like chapters 2, 3, 4, kind of shifting from like the identity, who we are, peace, which kind of ends in verse 10 of chapter 2, and then launching into the quote unquote practical part of the book or whatever. But it's great. Yeah, no, I think it was good context. I thought what I really loved about it was as I was working on during the Sunday school hour, working on sermon discussion questions for our life groups that meet this week, was the honoring the emperor verses that you spent a lot of your time on there. That would be 13 and 14. That they're like bookended by 12, which talks about doing good deeds. So that the Christians will see your conduct, that they won't malign you, that even though they malign you, they'll see your good deeds and glorify God. And then verse 15, for God wants you to silence ignorant and foolish people by doing good, that it's like the idea of like honoring the emperor is like bookended by these two ideas. I thought it was really great that you brought 12 in for that reason. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. One of the things that's kind of been on my mind, I feel like lately, is this idea of like, don't watch people's lips, but watch their feet. And which is, I mean, it's a deep weakness for us as preachers. Like we spend our life talking, and it's sometimes very challenging to have our feet keep up with our mouths. And so that's kind of what Peter's doing, is he's like, okay, this is who you are, but it's not enough just to give lip service to that. What is your actual feet doing in the world? Which this kind of a passage can come off very like hard, because it does feel like the ethical implications of who we are. And we all look at our own lives and we're like, man, oh, I don't know if I do that.
Yeah.
And if I do it, I certainly don't do it very well. And so it's a pain point, you know, for a sermon when you know that that's true.
Yeah, for sure. We have talked a lot like offline about the like trust only movement, or like the lips versus feet thing. That actually popped into my head last night when Olivia was brushing her teeth, because she was standing in front of the mirror doing absolutely nothing. I said, Olivia, are you brushing your teeth? She said, yes. And I said, now I hear you saying that you are brushing your teeth. I don't actually see you brushing your teeth. But that exact phrase like popped into my head just last night.
That's funny.
It's like, come on, girl, get to it. You took us on a bit of a roller coaster at the beginning of the sermon, quoting or referencing John Stott, followed by David Foster Wallace, followed by Mean Girls. I wasn't sure what to do with that like specific combination. But you used the movie Mean Girls to talk a lot about honor and shame. I don't know if you want to double click on that a little bit. That was a huge foundational piece to the rest of the sermon. But yeah, talk a little bit more maybe about honor and shame in First Peter and what you were trying to accomplish there, which you referenced already as your like 3 a.m. wake up call. But yeah, talk a little bit about how that like undergirds this whole idea of honoring the emperor. Help us understand the passage.
Yeah, I mean, I think can be indulgent sometimes for preachers to like start talking about the act of preaching in a sermon. Like, I know that that's true, but I wanted to like clearly communicate the complexity of like our horizon and applying it to this one, because you know what Ben Nelson emailed us when we started this sermon, he talked to us about exile language and how sometimes that can be misunderstood in our moment. And so like what's happening to these elect exiles in, you know, these cities like Pontus and Cappadocia isn't the same thing that's happening to us today.
Right.
And so I think we can get really quick afield, especially like in our moment, like say if you have a quote unquote pagan emperor or government leaders or city officials who stand for like policies that maybe go against the grain of some of our like Christian understanding of who we are to be in the world. Like we can quickly like say, this is the same thing that Peter's people are dealing with. And it's not really the same thing.
Right.
One, because Peter's group is a minority people group in a majority culture, much more so than American Christians are in our moment.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to try to like touch at least how like this is a complex horizon that doesn't exactly mash up equally. However, the honor shame piece does in some of the ways we're moving as a society, where we have been a guilt, individual guilt culture, and we're moving more into a communal shame culture. And how does that then help us understand this passage a little bit better? Because that definitely is Peter's world, and we're moving in that way.
Yeah.
And so I felt like it was a cleaner touch point to what we're actually experiencing in our moment with honor shame, and especially the ways that we perpetuate honor shame in our circles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I really like that. Yeah. I think you using Stott, you talked about the two horizons. I think one of the ways that I think about this too, I think this comes from the book, like Grasping God's Word. I don't know if you've ever come, it's like kind of a, kind of like layperson level or like undergraduate level, like kind of hermeneutics textbook. So like how to interpret the scriptures. And when they talk about the interpretive journey, they talk about how you at some point have to identify like how wide the river is like to cross between like the text and like our own day.
Yeah, that's good.
And so, which you referenced that, but like, yeah, you look at like Leviticus, right? Or even just like, how do we think about like Genesis and like the genre and the world that it was written to? Like, that's like, super wide. That's like Mississippi River, like Nile River, like massive.
Right.
And the New Testament in general is like a much smaller river, right? Mm-hmm. These are letters being written post Jesus's like death and resurrection, like to Christians, like to a church, but like there still is a river.
Yeah.
So we have to still like figure out how wide is that river and like what is the bridge we have to build over it. And if we ignore the river and pretend like there's no river, that can get us into like some weird situations.
Yeah. And that's where Mean Girls comes in, because Mean Girls, you know, I think of any, you know, and this isn't necessarily a modern movie anymore. I mean, it was 2004. So, you know, whenever you choose a illustration from a show or whatever, you know, you're not going to hit everybody.
Yeah, it's sure.
I go to detail to try to like with most of these things to draw people in, unless it's a Seinfeld reference or something that's just in passing. So I thought that it encapsulated honor shame culture for us in a very particular way to at least introduce us to the idea, and particularly the idea that if that honor is a commodity in the ancient world that was precious.
Yeah.
And being precious means it wasn't just available to everyone.
Right.
And so how do you move to a position of honor when you're in a position of shame? Well, you really can't.
Yeah.
And Peter is acknowledging this reality to this church that's occupied by all these different types of people in these little house churches. They have all these different lower class, lower caste system people. Like, how they're not trying to ascend to an upper echelon of culture because they can't.
Right.
And yet, their message is salvation for all.
Right.
Those in the higher caste and those even in lower caste than they may exist in currently.
Yeah.
And how the gospel transcends all of those boundary markers. for us, and in a sense elevates us through our lowness to be with God. And so that's the way the ethics is supposed to be played out, is from this, like, we've been elevated into the highest relationship. We are in dynamic communion with the living God because of Jesus through the Spirit. That should make us into a very peculiar people, no matter what caste we occupy.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good. I really liked how you talked about like honor being like a limited or like non-renewable resource, was kind of the phrase that I wrote down, just sort of thinking about that more from like the natural world, that yeah, like we can regrow trees and like make more paper, but like we can't like quickly like make more diamonds, you know, or whatever, like whatever, you know, all the different like non-renewable type resources that are limited, and how honor functions that way. I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, it is interesting to think about that too, with what Peter is saying when he talks about honoring the emperor and honoring all people. There's not like a reciprocity to it, that it's not about like you honoring them so that they will honor you. Like, that's not the point. It actually jumps, the honor jumps like straight to praise, straight to God, and like bypasses us as individuals. It isn't, but like the way of the world is like, it's tit for tat, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we honor because we want to be honored.
Or because we get honor, and we shame because we've been shamed. And I mean, we know this in our own hearts.
For sure, right.
Like, it's part of how we process like validity and justification for our very existence. It's the machine that's working overdrive. It's causing us to be anxious. It's causing us to be afraid. It's causing us to be nostalgic. Like, all that stuff's happening inside of us. And it's happening at a cultural level as well. Like,
yeah,
in all the different networks of relationships that we move in, it's happening. And yet the gospel says, no, you don't have to like engage in that game, because you have been honored by God. And it like it elevates honor in a sense, but it also like relativizes it in some ways. And that's why, you know, Peter's like, yes, honor the emperor and honor everyone.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the passage ends with those, that commands. And we can be like Oprah passing out, you get honor and you get honor and you get honor. We can actually be that way, even though honor doesn't work like that in the world.
Yeah.
I think that's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, for sure. And we could probably talk for like an hour by itself just on the social media component of this. So like, I don't want to necessarily derail us for too long. I did think your illustration of the female Phillies fan was both like perfect and painful. Especially sitting here this morning as the Phillies are down 2-0 to your Dodgers.
So sad.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
Injuries are a thing. But I think that was really interesting, like that illustration. And even I was listening to a podcast yesterday, just like some Ryder Cup follow-up stuff. And like, I don't know if you heard the story about the comedian that was serving as like a tea starter. And like, she kind of got the crowd stirred up with like some inappropriate chants towards the European team. Well, allegedly she's a member of Atlanta Athletic Club, and like, they're potentially voting her and her husband out of the club this week.
Oh no.
But again, same thing, like social media created this firestorm.
Yeah.
And now this like institution feels the need to respond, and it's like potentially going to ruin this woman's like life to some degree, at least,
right?
Her recreational life and like social standing, which is pretty wild. So it was kind of crazy that you referenced that Sunday. And then I was listening to a podcast yesterday. I was like, oh my gosh, like,
this happens.
Yeah. Like another example. Yeah. So anyway, I don't know if you want to say anything more about like how social media, like, which you kind of touched on a little bit, but how it just sort of amps these things up like to the highest degree. But
I mean, the reality that we can go from having status to no status overnight because of one action is real in our world.
Yeah.
And it can cause some of us like to have fear about, you know, even being engaged in a public life in any sort of way.
Sure.
And you don't even have to be engaged in public life in some of this. Like the Phillies fan, like she was not necessarily engaged in any sort of public life, but she became a public figure.
Right.
Because of her actions, and then she was canceled.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, Peter's audience has already been canceled. Like the Roman Empire is, even though they may have been sent to occupy these parts of the empire, because of their allegiance to King Jesus, they have been demoted from their positions, or are being demoted, in the process of being demoted from their positions society. So they are already nobody's outsiders. And then what happens when you are nobody and outsider? Where do you go? Well, you go to the church. The church becomes this place for nobodies and outsiders. And then their activity is an elevation activity where they're elevating one another. Mm. And they are elevating outsiders who are treating them like, even though they are the ones that canceled them. They're the ones that have cast them out. They are then elevating them. Like, what kind of ethic does that say?
Right.
If the Phillies fan or this comedian
right.
doesn't go online to then castigate those who have castigated her, but instead does the work of elevating them, honoring them. What does that say about them and consequently the God that they're worshiping or serving? Like, this is why Christianity grew.
Mm, yeah.
It did not grow because it ascended and then knocked out those who were not like them. It was in the business of ascending people, all people, regardless of their class or status. That's a pretty convicting, I think, word for all of us.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I want to get, I'm kind of walking through your sermon with the notes in front of me in like a little bit of like chronological order. I do want to get to like what you kind of landed on as application and think a little bit about how we do this. Mm-hmm. But before we get there, I think there's maybe one or two more things to touch on. So I want to pick back up with what you were saying in a minute. But a couple more things that stuck out to me in the sermon was you talked about a little bit about how we're all slaves to something. And so Christianity is not about being free of servitude, but it's just about changing masters, mm-hmm. Which I think is exceedingly biblical and a great point, but it totally grates against our like American identity mm-hmm. as like individualistic, like free. I can do what I want. Nobody can tell me what to do. But we as followers of Jesus do live in a space where, we're not totally free to do whatever we want because we do have a master still. We've moved from one that, in the case of like the reign of sin or like the world, flesh and the devil or whatever titles you want to put on that, like one that, beats us down and leads to death to one who's like gracious and leads to life, but it's still a master nonetheless. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which I thought was a really great point.
Yeah. I mean, I probably could have like spent even more time on that reality. Like it was kind of mentioned in at least the master part was missing more in passing than like kind of beat
right,
down.
Right.
I didn't beat the drum of that probably even enough, but I did think that that's really important that we're all going to be slaves to something. So if God is calling us to be bond servants to Him, or doulos is the Greek word, very famous tattoo in the
early
2000s.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I was tempted at one point. Yeah. I knew a guy that had it college. Yeah.
No big ear piercings though with the anvil on the doorpost. No, maybe we should go back to that. What do you think about that, Whippo?
Ear piercing?
Yeah, ear piercing. Big old gauge. Yeah. I'm a slave to Jesus. If Jesus is our master, and He is gracious and kind and loving, then what He's calling us to as His servants is for our freedom. Both our freedom, like internally, freedom from sin, death, the devil, but also free to like love, which is, again, Peter's a big thing. Holiness is displayed in your love of God and your love of people. And then there's this freedom to move into these, again, if you don't have worldly honor anyway, it's been taken away and you only have shame in the sense of the world, and that then Jesus elevates you to this position of honor, the gospel then means that we should be most free to be humble.
Yeah.
To be not defensive, to be not nostalgic. Mm. Most free to be that way. And yet I think most of us know it's very hard to trust that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's easier to trust a master who demands certain things of you that are very explicit and laid out. And you know you're going to get reward for that from that master immediate. You're going to get the dopamine hit. You're going to get the, you know, when you send that tweet of your defensive tweet, or maybe Twitter's not the right thing, your Instagram post,
you know
you're going to get immediate feedback from both the trolls and the your fans, your choir that you're preaching to. And there's a rush that comes from that. That's immediate.
For sure.
And
yeah.
That master like gives you immediate feedback. God operates kind of like differently with us.
Yeah.
And that's why it may be harder to trust at times.
Yeah. And And the things that Jesus calls us to do, like you said at one point, like seem weak or feel soft. And so like when the things that our master is calling us to do don't fit into like the cultural moment necessarily, like it does feel hard because you just feel like you stick out.
Yeah, that's good.
You gave one other sort of like negative example, and then we'll jump in like on the positive side. But like, but you said that because of all these things we're talking about, that we don't cover up evil and we don't have to play the what about them game, which I thought was a really interesting point as well. That like those are other temptations that we face with this whole idea of when we feel shamed, when we feel maligned, when we feel like we're not giving honor, and we want to push back. Like those are two other ways that we can do it, either trying to cover up our own stuff so that we look better, or trying to just make other people look worse, or at least justify our own bad behavior by their bad behavior seeming worse than ours. But I thought that was a really great point too. And maybe the point in the sermon where you got the most loud and animated as well.
I did. Yeah.
Your voice was up there, but it was good. I think it was like, I think it was a good rhetorical move, whether it was on purpose or not, but I don't know if you want to say any more about those things, but I thought those were good. Again, like I say, negative examples like of ways that we shouldn't respond, and then we can get into the positive, but I thought those were good.
I think one of the tragedies of our moment is that the church has, with its own internal sin, has played cover-up games way too frequently.
For sure.
We have not done our due diligence to protect the most vulnerable amongst us in doing that, whether that's because of the honor and position of those who occupy our lead in our churches, and we want to protect that. Even in the PCA right now, I think you have a fear from elders that people might smear a campaign, other elders, and there's almost like a frailty around that would keep us from actually doing the work of snuffing out evil in our midst.
Yeah.
And I think that's a mistake. Like, I think we have a job to be very concerned for the vulnerable amongst us.
Yeah.
And we should not be covering up evil in protecting the strong amongst us. And that's a scary thing because, there is clear judgment from the Lord when we do those things. It's the millstone around the neck, words that Jesus says to us. And so that's a big piece. And I think it bleeds in to like, okay, so when we have leaders and authority figures who are doing evil, like then what's our response? Because this is the whole,
right?
Like a lot was left unsaid intentionally in this sermon, because I think it's a sermon that we should ruminate on and talk about how we work that out, whether it's in life groups or other places.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, how do we do this hard work of both honoring and also like calling out evil when it's evil? Because that, there's a lot of different like voices that you're hearing in this world right now. They're calling out specific evils. This is why I added the tit for tat language, because I think the church has adopted a posture based on our current moment where we're really about like, if you're going to use this language, then I can use this language.
Mm.
If you're going to throw your weight around with harsh words and like clear prophetic truth, then we can do the same thing. And yet I don't think that's what I don't think Peter gives us room for that.
Yeah.
In this passage. Like, I think he is pressing hard on us.
Right.
In our moment, especially, like, we are not to be in the shame business.
Yeah.
And certainly our actions, if we are abiding by this ethic, may shame the world in some ways.
Right.
Right. But that does not, but it's not because we've taken up their weapons of warfare.
Yeah. No, yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I was thinking about the word weapons too. That, yeah, it's Peter is, yeah, intentionally calling us not to use like the weapons and strategies and like warfare tactics of the world, but to use different ones.
I mean, I just feel like the church right now just is so prone to worldliness in the way that they think about these things. And I am too, as part of the church. And I think that's the place where we start is repentance.
Yeah.
For our ways of doing that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Which I think is, yeah, which is hard. As you were talking to it, my mind thought about, like the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast, like when that came out. I tend to be one who falls on the side of thinking that, it was really helpful. And I think Mike Cosper and CT did a good job of trying to be fair and honest and tell stories, celebrate things that should have been celebrated, but also be willing to say the things that needed to be said. And I remember like one of the criticisms from some parts of the church was like, hey, why are we putting out like all of our bad behavior out there for the world to see? Like, doesn't this make the church look bad? And there was a lot of criticism like for the podcast for doing that. Like, why should we air our dirty laundry? This is a poor witness like for the church. But I think on the flip side, it's like, people that aren't in the church like know that's happening anyway. Like they can see it with their own eyes. They can read the news articles that are on like non-Christian sites or whatever. They can see and look up the records and they can see the stuff on, you know what I mean? And so like by trying to not talk about it at all, that there's just a way of covering it up and like being honest and authentic about our own sin and shortcomings and failures. It's not a poor witness to the world. I think it's showing that like we're human. Just like you.
Especially if our world is all about the business of covering it up. Like, again, this is like an ethic that then proves like the Jesus that we follow is our Jesus. And even if it's hard, even if it dismantles us in some ways.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about like quote unquote application and then we'll get to questions. And these kind of go together some too, but you said at the end of the sermon, which I did want to ask you about, like your choice for application was very like general and open-ended. I don't want to say vague because I don't mean it like in a negative way. But you basically just, your application was basically just verse 17, like honor everyone, love the church, fear God, honor the emperor. And you use the words like social, ecclesiastical, spiritual, local, physical, or you could throw political onto that as well. Which I really liked you using those different little words. That's fun. There's like a holistic way that he's kind of saying, hey, in all these different spaces you occupy, all these different groups you're a part of, all these different facets of life, like positively, like honor, love, fear, honor, submit, like whatever. So like give us the answer we're all looking for, Justin. Like how do we do these things?
Yeah. So I don't know. I think these are the way it, I really did leave this as the application point because I think it is something we do in community.
Yeah.
And that it is holistic.
Right.
And I don't think that there's like wiggle room for us to just say, well, I know I can love the church and so I'm going to like do that and not, you know, honor, you know, the barista who messes up your order, you know, and that, again, all these things are like, there's all sorts of ways that we fail at this and that Jesus's mercy is still ours. That doesn't mean that it doesn't matter. Like it matters. It matters for verse 12. Like our good deeds are a way that people are won over to the way of Jesus. But I do love that he ends this very holistically and then like comes back to what he started with, which was, you know, again, if Nero is the emperor, imagine what that feels like as news reports spread about what Nero's doing to your brothers and sisters. And yet Peter does not relent on the call to honor. In counseling, like one of the things that my counselors tried to help me with as I kind of grapple with my story is how do I honor my story and tell the truth about it? Like, yeah, it's kind of two things that I hold. And I didn't say this in the sermon, but like I did think about this personally as I was trying to apply it. Is like I honor everyone, but that doesn't mean I can't tell the truth.
Yeah, that's good.
It doesn't mean I can't tell the truth about what the emperors of the world are doing, but I can still honor them. And I think this is a tough thing for us, Redeemer. Like, we should be praying for our president, even though we might have certain like things about our president that abhor us.
Yeah.
In this moment.
Yeah.
And that would be true no matter who the president is. But in this particular situation, like, we see the things, hear the things that are said, whether they're said at, you know, Charlie Kirk's memorial service after, you know, his wife says, "I'm forgiving," and our president kind of says the exact opposite. Like, you have to tell the truth that is not aligned with our way of the way of Jesus. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't still honor this person, the dignity of the human being and the position that human being occupies.
That's right.
We honor both of those things, even though we tell the truth. And that's really hard, y'all.
Yeah, for sure. I think the holistic nature of this, too, is really interesting as my mind's kind of like wandering as we're talking about, like, I feel like you could put, and I'm not going to attempt to do this on the fly because I would need to think about it more, but like with like the social piece, the ecclesiastical piece, the spiritual piece, like the local, physical, political piece, like you could probably put underneath these categories, like different, like, either like denominations or church traditions, like throughout church history that have like focused on only one of the four, or you could probably add more to that. And like, not that any of those are like in error, but they're all like an overemphasis on one instead of like trying to do all.
Yeah.
And there is a real call for us to like do all, which is like really hard. Like it feels like it would be easier just to focus on one and say, "Hey, like, I'm just going to worry about the fear of God thing. The other stuff feels too hard. I'm just going to focus on me, my spiritual life with God," just like pietistic, monastic.
Yep.
Like, I'm just going to go all into like the contemplative tradition, live there, ignore the rest.
Yeah.
And you could kind of say that for the other things too, but like Peter is in one verse and in four very short sentences is calling us to not do that.
Yeah.
To really live in all of those spaces, and to seek to do positive action in all those spaces. Not to withdraw, not to pull back, but to do good, to honor, which I think, yeah, man, it's super challenging. I think maybe the other thought that I would have, and Giorgio and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago from his sermon, is that there are going to be individuals of us within the church that probably do find more affinity with like one of these different spaces. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important that as the body of Christ together, we're doing all of this. Mm-hmm. Not that everybody has to be hyper, like, I mean, we all need to honor the emperor. So like here, I'm riffing on this a little bit, but like some of us are going to want to be like more maybe engaged in the political, like local, physical. Some are maybe going to want to be more engaged in the ecclesiastical or the social or whatever. And I think in some ways it's okay that people maybe tilt one way or the other a little bit, but we all need to be engaged in all of them and not abdicate our responsibility completely from any.
Yeah, I mean, we could have spent some time on the sermon just talking about how important it is to occupy each of these spheres well.
Yeah.
And I had a little bit in my actual manuscript about that, but I just didn't have the time to like expound upon it. But there is a sense that, yes, we're not trying to hide in the spirituality of the church, but we're also not trying to take over the world. Like the ethic of the church is not world takeover, world domination. It's a sacrificial love that permeates. It's the yeast in the dough.
Yeah.
It's unnoticeable until it permeates all the dough and it makes it rise and the whole dough is affected by it. That's the way of the kingdom. And it is small acts, most unseen.
Yeah.
But seen by God.
Yeah.
That are going to do that. I love how he kind of just like, when you think about honoring everyone, honor the emperor, like even those two things held up against each other is like, when we honor our president, let's say, but we also honor all those who have been undone.
Yeah.
By certain things that have happened by this current president. And you could say the thing about the previous president, you know, Biden. You honor him, and you also honor those who have been undone by the policies and actions by that president. And so honoring everyone becomes like a way of like, oh, we're not just like honoring our political power, that whatever that might be at the moment. We're honoring everyone, especially those who have been, you know, maybe victimized or hurt by these policies.
Yeah.
And we understand that as the church, and we can enter into it because we don't occupy a position, even if we've been sent out into the world and we have powerful positions in the world. We're not trying to protect that position because of the gospel.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I think we're approaching like the 40-minute mark here. Why don't we look at the questions real quick?
Yeah.
Make sure we touch on these, and then we can wrap up. So we got three questions in, and I mean I could read them, but I think I'll just say kind of summarize it a little bit here. But yeah, so first question is just about the idea of, hey, I'm hearing this message, the thing that I keep thinking about is all the ways that I have been wronged. And so it's hard for me to think about my own sin and the way that I have wronged others, just because of the intense emotions that are there, about people that have harmed me. And so maybe speak to that for a minute, Justin. How do we attempt to honor others? How do we attempt to not return shame when we're shamed, or malign others when we're maligned, but like grapple with the reality that like emotionally that's really hard, especially for those of us that have received a lot of like real harm and real hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. For if you have both, you know, again, the gospel is good news to those who both perpetrate and who have been perpetrated against. That's one of the beautiful things about the gospel, that our current moment, the gospels of our current moment don't necessarily offer. And so Peter, of course, later on in chapter 2, will say, we entrust ourselves to him who judges justly, and he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. I think Jeff, when he was on our pod, said these were his favorite verses in Peter.
Oh, yeah.
But we face our sin, our own ways that we've hurt, without despair, because Christ has borne those sins in his body. And we face the sins committed against us because God sees and will judge justly. And a practice to do that is, when you can see your sins clearly, you pray that the Lord would show you your heart, not so you can despair. But again, like sin, our sin means more mercy from God.
Hmm.
And so we see the ways we've hurt and maligned others, so that we can grasp hold of more mercy from God. And then we also like practice, because of that, we lament, we confess.
Yeah.
We entrust ourselves to God who sees when we've been hurt. And again, not easy in practice, but something that I think Peter calls us to.
Yeah. No, that's good. It makes me think of like Jesus's words, where he talks about like pulling the log out of your own eye before you pull the speck out of the others. But like the very one who calls us to that self-reflection is also the one who is our great high priest, who empathizes with that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's great. Second question is about, like, it brings in the idea of privilege. And so like, how do we, as like people of privilege, and I don't know exactly who wrote this question, but as somebody who has like some privilege, and you're interacting with somebody else who's also like a person of privilege, so not somebody who's like in our cultural moment, like marginalized in some way or another. And you have like two privileged people like arguing with each other, over something, like how do you engage, in those conversations? And like, when do you choose to pursue that? And when do you choose to kind of back out and say, hey, this may not make sense to even engage with this person in this situation.
Yeah. It's, you know, whether this is, I don't know if this is totally true, but we lived in an entrenched time where people are very entrenched in their values and beliefs.
Yeah.
So, and often it's privileged people, you know, arguing over these things. And so I think that's where this question comes from.
Yeah.
I think for Christians, like, I think if we start from a place of not certainty, like we're certain of one thing: Christ and him crucified.
Yeah.
And then everything else is like kind of held fairly loosely. So it's, we all have a blindness, and we start from that humble place, humility in its very nature is meant to disarm pride. So if we can come from a place of like that, we can maybe be curious instead of critical. We can engage empathetically with from our own story, right? Empathy is this place where you understand, you've been there before, you can enter in through empathy and say, I understand that. Even if you haven't been in the direct thing, you understand maybe the feelings associated with the thing, and you can enter in and you embody peace. And then that allows for nuance, you know, like if we come from this humble place, there is a role for nuance, and we can hold in the tension of grace and truth that Jesus kind of walks in. He is the one who's full of grace and truth. And so we can kind of through the Spirit embody that. There is a discernment, though, process that the question is asking for. Right. And I think Jesus also walked away. The disciples were told to walk away, to shake the dust off their feet from certain conversations. Is the conversation still open to grace? Is the dialogue moving towards mutual humility or greater hostility, deeper hostility? Am I acting from a place of love or the need to win? Is there space emotionally safe enough for the truth to be heard?
Right.
And then can you just entrust that person to God
and
his care without controlling the outcome or the narrative? I think those are some important questions to ask.
Yeah, I think that's really good. Yeah, I think humility and curiosity were definitely two of the words that came to my mind as well. And that you have to start from that place in these conversations. And I wonder if... like when do you end pursuit? Like it's part of the answer for when you end engaging in these conversations with a particular person, when they have proved over and over again that they're not coming from a place of humility and curiosity, that they're entrenched, that they are unwilling to hear you, unwilling to ask questions, unwilling, to even think about changing their mind, like unwilling or to be humble, that they're just prideful, arrogant. Is there a certain point where maybe you say, hey, this probably isn't worth continuing these, like we can still be friends. We're coworkers, our cubicles next to each other. Like we can stay in relation. And I think you should stay in relationship unless it's like, you know, really, really, really bad. But is it kind of just saying like, hey, I'm going to approach with this posture, but over time, if they don't have a similar posture, this is just not going to go anywhere. It's not worth it.
Yeah. Steve Cuss talks about you can only show up into a conversation with dealing with the anxiety that's in you. You can't get to the anxiety that's in another person.
Right.
You can't deal with the anxiety that exists between you. You really can't even deal with anxiety that's in the room. That's, you know, right now in our room is like political anxiety par excellence.
Yeah.
Like you can't really deal with that. You can only deal with what your anxiety is and how you're showing up into that situation.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what that allows you to be differentiated, which means you can stay connected.
Yeah.
It's not withdrawn.
Right.
It's connected, but you're differentiated from them to the degree that you don't have to get emotionally agitated and anxious.
Yeah. Yeah.
Harder to do than to say.
For sure. Yeah. You can only control yourself.
Yeah.
In those situations for sure. Yeah. Last question. How does the church both honor the emperor and maintain its prophetic role in society? I think it's a really great question. Obviously, you can think about so many different movements in the last 150 years where like the church played a key role and Christians and ministers played a key role in using their voice and mobilizing the church for great change. So how do we honor the emperor and yet still play a prophetic role and push for change in ways that we feel are good and right?
Yeah, I think, you know, honoring the emperor is respect without idolatry. So you're not idolizing the emperor or the emperor's policies. You're respecting it without that. And to fear God means, and again, Peter's, I think, poignant in doing this. Fear God is to, ultimate loyalty is to God. And because we don't cover up evil because we're free, that means we should have a prophetic voice. For sure, that prophetic voice does speak truth to power. When power becomes oppressive, corrupt, unjust, there is a role for the church to play to speak truth to that. But I still think it's winsome.
Yeah.
There's still dignity.
Right.
it's still empathetic in the sense that we understand as human beings, like our own sin. And so that we can enter into that with quiet respectfulness, bold, public, you know, depending on what the situation requires, it's rooted in love and truth, not partisan anger. Again, there is an anger at injustice and oppression that we should be rightfully moved to action, right? Our love moves us to action. And that's when we're most prophetic. It's probably most prophetic in our, again, our simple acts of love. And that's the submersive, you know, subversive submission, that it's a faithful defiance through humility, living under authority while quietly undermining evil with the good.
Yeah.
So what does that look like? I mean, I think what the church is trying to do, especially here in Winston, with just advocating for refugees, you know, that people that we want people to be in our country, we want them to be here legally, and we want to provide, to be a good host and be hospitable in that work. That is a act of defiance in our current moment of like fighting for that and speaking out for that. What's happening in the schools here in Winston? Like we've talked about that on this pod.
Yeah.
Like yesterday we talked about it in the worship service. It's like the simple acts of like showing up for the teachers and providing them a meal or showing up with a ream of paper. Like those are like defiant acts. Small, yes, but it could be a protest and stepping out and being public in your protest of some policy. That we are doing that though humbly, nonviolent, non-coercive. It's presence, faithful presence. And faithful presence is pursuit, offer of life, sacrificial love. Like that's how you know you're being faithfully present. You are engaged, you're connected. You're pursuing, you're offering life, life that's found through the gospel.
Yeah.
Like through Jesus. And it is ultimately your sacrifice, your sacrificial. It costs you something in the way that you're giving. And that is a subversive act.
Yeah. 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 That's good. I can't help but think about the irony of, our church is doing a lot to support Bolton Elementary, which is the school that was built that replaced the building that our church now owns. Mm-hmm. And then also we're sitting here in this office looking across the grounds at our Hawthorne House, which has been empty for too long now, with no refugee or immigrant families to put into it. And we just got to keep pushing forward in these things. Mm-hmm. I think that's all I got. Those are the only questions we had. Is there anything else that you want to double click on or touch on real fast? Then we can wrap up.
Yeah, man. I think this is this is a good one. The next handful of sermons are going to be challenging for us as a church. And so lots of different ways for this to wrangle us in a lot of different ways of wrangling as well. So
yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's great, man. Well, hey, I'll close us here. Thanks everyone for tuning in. I really appreciate you listening to us. Don't forget to use that QR code in the bulletin if you're with us on Sundays, or just email us. Otherwise, send us some questions. We'd love to answer those questions, stay in dialogue. And that's it for now. Yep. We'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, see you next time.